Welcome to this evening's event on, as you see, citizenship and transnationalism. I'm Simon Hicks. I'm the Harold Lasky Professor of Political Science here at the LSE. I'm the chair of this evening's event, and we have three excellent speakers. On my right, we have my LSE colleague, Simon Glendenning, who's Professor of European Philosophy here at the LSE. And we have Nancy Green, who's Professor of History at EHESS in Paris. And then we have Pap Ndiaye, is that how you said? Who's a Professor of History at Sciences Po. And so each of our speakers are going to speak for 8 minutes on the topic. I will then follow up with one or two questions, and they can respond to each other. And then we'll open up to questions and comments from the audience. Simon, you're going to kick off.
Yeah, thanks very much. And I'm going to take us back a little bit to some of the early days of thinking about transnational citizenship and transnationalism in Europe, and particularly the thought that's often called cosmopolitan, quite correctly, of the German thinker Immanuel Kant. And I want to kick off with something which has been in the news recently, and in fact has been one of the lines that has linked together many of the sessions in the Night of Ideas here at the LSE tonight, from Theresa May, where she said, "If you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere." And that statement, which was in a conference speech, gave rise to some rather self-righteously angry comments in the newspapers and by academics who didn't think that she understood very well what being a citizen of the world might mean if she was saying it meant that. And one letter to The Guardian from a London academic said this, and I'll read this, and then I just want to pick up on some things it says.
A letter to The Guardian by a London academic. Yeah. You kind of guess what they're going to say.
Absolutely right. Here we go. Theresa May is, in effect, repudiating Enlightenment values as a whole. For cosmopolitanism is the apex, and indeed the glory, of Enlightenment philosophy, encompassing liberty, equality, fraternity, and all our human rights. The greatest of all Enlightenment thinkers, Immanuel Kant, proposed the ideal of world citizenship as a means to achieve perpetual peace. Well, it's quite a rebuke, but actually, as far as the main claim goes, which is in relation to the thought of the greatest of all Enlightenment thinkers, Immanuel Kant, it's mainly no. That's not really what Kant was saying at all. And Kant very clearly and explicitly repudiates the idea, and for reasons I'll mention in a moment, repudiates the idea of a world republic or a world state in which individuals might be citizens of the world. Equally, he repudiated the idea that perpetual peace was or could be an aim in both national and transnational politics. And in fact, Theresa May was in some ways much, much closer to Kant and not repudiating the Enlightenment when she was thinking that something like a grouping of people into nations was the first, and Kant thought actually, the basic form of political membership. Kant could have said, if you believe you're only a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. Kant thought that there was a cosmopolitan hope, which I'll outline in a minute, and he thought there was something like an international relationship between states that involves citizens, but those will always have been citizens of states for him. And we can still think of Kant as the thinker of the cosmopolitical and the cosmopolitan, and in a certain way as the apex of Enlightenment philosophy, but not in the way that author to The Guardian suggested. And one thing we can think here is that, in fact, Kant is articulating something that one might call the European political idea par excellence when he discusses cosmopolitanism. There's a Lithuanian-born French philosopher called Emmanuel Levinas, who's quite famous for saying Europe, this is not a historical proposition, it's about the nature of the space that we're in. Europe is the Bible and the Greeks. So whenever you get a sort of coming together of that tradition of two traditions, you're looking at something very European. Now, in 1997, when the French philosopher Jacques Derrida was at a conference in on cosmopolitanism in Sussex, at Sussex University, he reminded the audience about the legacy of cosmopolitanism. And he says, "The tradition of cosmopolitanism comes to us from, on the one hand, Greek thought, with the Stoics, who have the concept of the citizen of the world. But also you have in St. Paul, in the Christian tradition, a certain call for a citizen of the world as precisely a brother. St. Paul says that we are all brothers, that is, sons of God, so we are not foreigners. We belong to the world as citizens of the world, and it is this tradition that we could follow up until Kant." Indeed. And when Kant begins to think about this, this relationship of an international or transnational dimension of existence, he begins to project a future for humanity in which a certain movement, not beyond the nation states, but between nation states, moves us all, and he thought the whole of humanity, towards what he called a cosmopolitan existence. And amazingly, 200 years ago, writing, or a bit more than 200 years ago, writing in 1795, Kant says that it will start in Europe in about 200 years. He says, imagine you're all European states, there's too many of you, but imagine that's what you are, and the two of you are at war. The effects which an upheaval in any state as a result of war with another state produces upon all the others on our continent, where we're all so closely linked by trade, these are so perceptible that these other states are forced by their own insecurity to offer themselves as arbiters, albeit without any legal authority, so that they indirectly prepare the way for a great political body of the future without precedent in the past. Although this political body exists for the present only in the roughest outlines, it nonetheless seems as if a feeling is beginning to stir in all the members, each of which has an interest in maintaining the whole. And this encourages the hope that after many revolutions, the highest purpose of nature, a universal cosmopolitan existence, will at last be realized as the matrix within which all the original capacities of the human race may develop. So he's looking forward to a time first in Europe and then to the whole world where this international relationship will take a stable form through this unprecedented institution, which he called a Pacific Federation. Not a federal state, but a federation of free states. A grouping of free states together in this formation. And he said three things about those states. One is that they will all be characterized by an effort to achieve the maximization of the freedom of each of the citizens in the state. A freedom made possible by a single common legislation, a rule of law, to which everyone is subject, which restricts each, but in order to maximize the freedom of all. Secondly, international relations between states would be similarly constituted, where each state is restricted in what it can do internationally by law, by international law, but in order to maximize the sovereignty that each one retains. So in this new institution, you pool sovereignty, but you retain some, and what you retain is enhanced in virtue of the fact that you're no longer threatened by war. And thirdly, and this is the cosmopolitan hope, final point, each member state will have, as part of its constitution, a cosmopolitan right. This is an idea of free movement of citizens, a right to go anywhere in the federation without being treated with hostility. But freedom of movement for Kant was thought of as limited. It's not a right to be especially friendly treated. So you're not, when you have a guest to your house, there is a kind of assumption that you should show them a good time. But in Kant's idea of the cosmopolitan hospitality, there's no obligation on the part of the host to, as it were, be especially friendly. There's no what he called a gastrecht, but there is an obligation not to treat them with hostility while they are on your territory, so long as they behave in a peaceable manner. So you have this right of travel, but limited, not a guest right. Also, he thought you wouldn't have a right to stay forever. It's a right of a stranger to come into your place. And the German word he used was Besuchsrecht. Now, the modern English translation, in a slightly archaic formulation, calls this a right of resort, which I don't hardly know what it means. An earlier translation calls it, more beautifully, a right of visitation, which is a bit like what a ghost does when it comes into your place. You don't know who is coming. Anyone can come. Anything in a certain way can come. And you've got to be, as it were, self-constituted that you show respect and do not treat them with hostility as long or until as they behave in some way that's not peaceable. Now, one of the features of the post-war development of the European Union, which was explicitly taking up the Kantian idea, was the hope that ever closer union would lead to the eventual formation of a federal state. It's a very, very un-Kantian idea. But he too believed in something like ever closer union, which was this, in this federation of free states, a way of approaching conditions in which war becomes increasingly less likely. He always thought it could sometime break out, but you could nevertheless, through this institutional cosmopolitan condition, make it increasingly less likely. A world state, though, or a world citizenship, he completely rejected. He said it would be a universal despotism and the graveyard of freedom. Now, this is a paradoxical idea that the getting rid of all states produces a massive instability in Kant's view. I won't go on about that, but that is his.
Simon, thank you very much. Nancy.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to talk about citizenship and transnationalism from a somewhat different perspective as an immigration historian, but questioning whether or not these two concepts are in contradiction or not. Certainly, immigration is not new, nor is transnationalism, even though the term has become really quite à la mode in the last, I'd say, 10, 20 years particularly. But both questions about immigration and transnationalism raise questions about belonging and, of course, about citizenship. These questions, I think, are both have to be addressed and thought about both in relationship to individuals and how individuals relate to their citizenship or relate to a form of transnationalism, but also how the states relate to questions of citizenship and transnationalism, and states plural, because if someone moves, it's both the country of origin and the country of arrival which will be involved. And certainly countries of arrival have, we know and we see in front of our eyes currently and repeatedly, are often sort of on the defensive about what's happening and what how they treat newcomers. But we also have to think about the countries of origin and how they perceive the people who leave. So for much of the 19th century, as you may or may not know, it was really the British concept of perpetual allegiance, which, seen from the country of origin, looked fairly suspiciously on those who left. In other words, that one was supposed to have a perpetual allegiance to the place from which you were born. To leave sort of willy-nilly and change one's either a place of belonging and one's belonging in terms of even their identity was frowned upon. People who left were sometimes seen as traitors, abandoning home, hearth, and ancestors. But on the other hand, people leaving could also be seen, and there's a big literature on emigration in the 19th century, which talks about spreading of civilization. It could be an imperial venture as well, so that people who would leave and go elsewhere could either be seen as spreading the civilization of the home country or seen suspiciously as traitors who are abandoning the home country. From the receiving end, this perhaps we know the most about. The most has been studied about how, and we again are sort of living a period most fraughtfully currently, about how newcomers are treated, how foreigners are treated, and how immigrants are treated. To what extent are they seen as potential citizens or as sort of maybe suspicious transnationals? We know, and historically, that when countries need laborers' arms are open and that there are periods in which immigration is favored and even encouraged, when space is plentiful, when labor is needed. On the other hand, we also know that there are spikes of xenophobia, and this would fit with treating guests with hostility. And these spikes of xenophobia can also take different forms. In the United States, in the 19th century, one of the major forms of xenophobia was a form a religious form of xenophobia against the Papists, against when the Irish came in large numbers to the United States. But it could also be political. The anti-red fears of the early part of the 20th century were another form of dismissal of foreigners. These oscillations between welcome and rejection, I think we need to keep in mind, because certainly for me as a historian, they lead me to have periods of great despair and pessimism, but also over the long term, sometimes forms of hope or optimism. After all, the repeated nature of xenophobia, the repeated nature of rejection or hostility to guests or rejection of the other, is well documented. This is true even for the United States, even though the United States up until very recently is often talked about as the nation of immigrants and therefore welcoming, et cetera. But there have been very specific periods of xenophobia in the United States that are well documented. To see these repetitions of xenophobia, of course, is somewhat despairing, more than somewhat. It's very despairing. On the other hand, we also know that as immigrants come and settle and then become part of a country, that the newcomers, that then they become the old comers in a way, and then it's the newcomers that are stigmatized. And this is, on the one hand, what we forget about is how the older immigrants did, in fact, settle in, even though at the time they were considered to be totally unassimilable and not possibly part of the body politic. So the fact that they do eventually settle in, sometimes they themselves then criticize the newcomers. But there is at least a story that we need to remember about how the old newcomers were in fact terribly stigmatized when they first came, but then eventually became part of the countries into which they had settled. Now, these complex and often conflicting views at the point of arrival, again, are fairly well known. They've been studied, the history of immigration, the history of immigration policy, the history of citizenship and citizenship laws, or ways in which we can clearly document the periods in which countries of immigration open their arms or periods in which they are refusing or closing down the borders. Less studied is the perspective from the point of departure, and this is something which I think in the new study of transnationalism also needs to be seen. How do countries see people who leave? How do they, those who take off to settle somewhere else and become transnationals, what happens to them? Are they no longer citizens? Do they no longer want to be citizens? To what extent does the country of origin even consider them still as part of the country of origin? And so do home states, what do they do about their citizens abroad? There's a lot to be done on consulates, it seems to me, because consulates, of course, not only are barriers to people coming in and when you have to go there to get a visa, but they're also places where citizens turn when they are in trouble, when they're abroad, for example. And they're a place where we can see also the uses of citizenship, how even transnationals, and this I think in the history of both migration and now what we're calling transnationalism, how does transnationalism nonetheless draw upon citizenship? How do people who have gone abroad nonetheless maintain their ties, use their ties, go to their consulates, complain, want help, whine. Some of the work that I've done on the first half of the 20th century about Americans in Paris, a seemingly well-known topic, but in fact there were complaints by the consulate about, even from the 19th century, about American citizens coming to the consulate, being just kind of whining about things and asking help from their consulate, which is a way of showing how they were trying to use their citizenship, it seems to me. They would complain that, you know, they were being charged too much for candles. This was in the 19th century by the innkeepers. One of my favorite stories is a woman in the 20th century who, in the 1920s, who had a tiff with a hat maker in France. So what does she do? She goes to the consulate and she says to the consulate, you know, I can't get my hat back from the hat maker who's angry at me because of my friend who didn't come through on her order, and so she's kept my hat and I can't get it back. Well, here is this kind of entitled American woman going to her consulate for what seems admittedly a rather trivial matter. The surprise, of course, is that actually the consular officer goes with her, goes to the hat maker, and gets the hat back. So this is a good... But I think, again, the question is, how do people use their citizenship? I mean, today I think trying to go to the American consulate to get a hat back would probably not work at all. So there are periods, however, when it could. But the point is, how do both countries perceive their citizens who have gone abroad and who have presumably lessened their ties to the place of origin? What sort of protection of interest is involved on the part of the home countries? How does that citizenship work? What are the practices of citizenship, and how do individuals implement it? These stories one can look at over the 20th century, I think, do go to the heart of these questions about the relationship between citizenship and transnational behavior. How do transnational individuals negotiate their identity? How do they negotiate their belonging? How may they use their citizenship? And then, in the end, we also come to something which I think is very important, and that is that class is obviously also a big factor. Most immigrant workers are not called transnationals. The language of transnationalism, as it's being used in the last 20 years or so, sort of ignores class difference, or the use of transnationalism is often more referring to an elite class of the Mrs. Baker types who would go to the consulate to get their hats back. Or, as an oft-cited title in The Guardian put it by an African woman, why are white people expats while the rest of us are immigrants? Class matters. It's part of, I think, the way in which the different terms that are being used for transnational behavior we need to pay attention to. And some reflections then on the term transnationalism itself are in order. I'd argue that its use and its expanded use in the last 20 years, both in immigration history but also in, of course, a variety of other domains, has been part of the late 20th century language on globalization, on flexibility, on mobility, fluidity, circulation, so that we have a sort of a magma of types of a language that is making is which is emphasizing mobility, emphasizing movement, emphasizing circulation. Political scientists began using the term transnationalism in the 1970s, but it really took off in immigration studies in the 1990s. And the use, and also in American history, for the internationalization of American history, the term was used as well. Anthropologists and historians who began using it in the 1990s, one could almost say that maybe it's historically situated between, let's say, 1989 and 2001. That the fall of the Berlin Wall, when we thought that walls were out of favor, unfortunately this is no longer the case, up until September of 2001, when borders came back and now are being recreated everywhere. This has led to a debate about how new is transnationalism, not only what is its relationship to citizenship, but how new is it? And historians and anthropologists have had a kind of interdisciplinary debate on this, which I won't go into right now. But my argument is simple and twofold, and I'll more or less conclude with this, that first of all, transnationalism is not new. And this is what the historians kept saying to the anthropologists, is that we've already seen this, both in migration history and more generally. It's not just a new or a late 20th century phenomenon, even if it's the late 20th century where this emphasis on mobility and transnationalism has taken off. But furthermore, it's not as easy as it looks, and not just because Mrs. Baker was able to get her hat back when other people today would not be able to. But one of the points is that even if, and there are many examples that one could give, but even for elite migrants from the early part of the 20th century on, language, laws, customs of country have always been challenging for the consciously mobile. So that transnationalism itself is fraught with various kinds of constraints that I think need to be recognized in terms of actual possibilities for mobility. But that there is no absolute opposition between citizenship and transnationalism. On the other hand, transnationalism is not a sort of limitless possibility of mobility. And I think that historically and as a contemporary issue, of course, it's now, I think, become clearer and clearer. But we'll leave that to a question between
Nancy, thank you very much.
Good evening. What I want to briefly discuss tonight is the connection between external borders, boundaries, frontiers, that is the borders separating nation states, and internal boundaries, more invisible lines between various groups of people, most often citizens, lines separating the us from them. My argument is that the harsher the European countries and the United States under Trump are vis-à-vis migrants, the more difficult are the lives of minorities living within these nation states. Cosmopolitanism is being under attack in the United States, in France, in the US, in many countries throughout the world. Powerful extreme right nationalist organizations are on the rise, denouncing external threats and internal threats in the same time. Since the mid-1970s, the French government and other European governments have closed the national borders to non-European migrants. This is when, in France, for example, starting in 1974, African migrants who couldn't come back home and be replaced by family siblings, as it was customary before, settled in France for good. In the late 1980s, in the 1990s and later, migrant policies were even more tightened in such a way that migrating to Europe has become even more difficult than migrating to the US. There is a flow of migrants now going to the United States, for example, from Africa. Europe is seen as a fortress with a huge cost in terms of human lives. Every year, thousands perish trying to reach Europe. The Mediterranean Sea can be seen as a cemetery. Yesterday, Donald Trump announced that the US government would carry out the construction of a wall separating the United States from Mexico. What hasn't been studied so well, I think, recently are the domestic effects of these harsh migrant policies. Many persons in France, which I recently interviewed, while being sympathetic to the plight of migrants, many helping them in Paris, for example, and elsewhere in northern France, are not fully aware of the consequences on our European societies. A major effect of the stringent migrant policies of Europe, including France, is that these policies do not only harm those who try to settle in the old continent, but also large numbers of local populations, more specifically the national, the citizens, sometimes foreigners, who can be associated, who look like migrants, undesirable foreigners. The boundaries between the national and the foreign tend to be echoed within the nation states with the creation of internal boundaries. These internal boundaries make a distinction between nationals who look national and nationals who don't look nationals. In other words, ethno-racial boundaries, which are not supposed to exist, of course, in officially colorblind countries such as France. These boundaries may create interesting new identities. When arriving in the metropole in France at the end of World War II, Frantz Fanon realized that he was considered as a black man, that is, as a foreigner. Much to his surprise, as he tells in Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, black skin, white mask, a cab driver hailed him in the street, saying, "Hey, le noir, hey, the black guy." Fanon writes, I quote him, "The Antillais," he comes from Martinique, the West, French West Indies, "doesn't think of himself as a black. He thinks of himself as Antillais. Blacks live in Africa. Subjectively, intellectually, the Antillais behaves as a white man. He realizes that he's black once in Europe, and when hearing about blacks, he knows that he is concerned as much as a Senegalese," end quote. I interviewed many people from the West Indies who dismiss the legitimacy of color distinctions while acknowledging that most often they are indeed considered as black persons. That is quite not quite French. most black persons tell the same story. They are being asked, where do you come from? And if they answer, well, I'm from Paris or I'm from Bordeaux, then people say, but where do you really come from? All right, as if they were coming from a foreign country, obviously. In this sense, these people, let's say non-whites, generally speaking, can be considered as a minority in the sense given by Louis Wirt, the famous Chicago sociologist, in a great 1945 article, The Problem of Minority Groups. He says a minority doesn't have a demographic meaning, but a socio-political one, a group subjected to various forms of collective discrimination. Many non-whites have stories of discrimination to tell. Not all of them, for sure. Being non-white does not necessarily imply a personal experience, but a potential experience of discrimination. Of course, they are vulnerable vis-à-vis racist and discriminatory behaviors. The notion of minority, following Louis Wirt, should then be understood as a class of vulnerability. Frenchness in France, Frenchness is still associated to whiteness. It is possible that it is the same here when it comes to Englishness, maybe something like that. The experience of looking foreign is the experience of being race profiled by the police looking for undocumented migrants. So when talking about external boundaries, when you have to, for example, when traveling from France to the UK, which I did this morning, I had to show my passport. But many people in France have to pass boundaries every day, internal boundaries, because they are being asked for their papers as if they were crossing an invisible line within their own country. It is to be screened at the airport as if the passport was forged or stolen. The unmistakable feeling of being not quite French, being foreign in your own country. Internal boundaries. You have to show your ID. So we are talking about walls, not walls of brick and mortar, as Trump is dreaming of, but walls of paper. Benjamin wrote on the walls of paper and how effective walls of paper can be. There are, let's say, two main attitudes when discussing the reaction of non-whites vis-à-vis migrants. The first attitude, I would say, is a distance vis-à-vis migrants, so as not to be associated to them. This is something I have witnessed in Paris, with many non-whites trying to help the migrants, but being sure that they are not around when the police comes, for example, because they are afraid of being associated to the migrants and being in trouble. This is, of course, perfectly understandable. There is another attitude which I have also seen, that of a more obvious solidarity encouraged by family connections with the migrants themselves. That is why I think that in France, the political organization of minorities, which has been taking shape for 15 years or so, could be seen in a pragmatic way as a self-defense against some of the most burdensome kinds of racial injustice, with the ultimate objective of de-racializing European societies so that skin color does not matter more than eye color or hair color. But it is also, as we are witnessing with Hispanics nowadays in the United States, protesting Trump's will to build a wall and also to deport undocumented migrants, it could also be seen as a way to reinforce the links of solidarity with foreigners and migrants. That is somewhat to reinvent the possibility of what some philosophers in France call a neo-citizenship, new forms of transnationalism. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Fascinating. fascinating stuff. So as we've not actually got that much time left, I think we should open it up to questions in the audience. And we have a microphone at the front here, so I see the woman there about four rows back, first hand up. We'll say your name and who you are and then the question.
My name is Sarah Luxmore. I'm a student here at LSE. My question is related to the idea of citizenship and nationality and belonging and being an outsider and insider. And if the semantics around nationalism, are they still applicable these days? For example, you were saying that that people who leave the country of their origin are seen with kind of hostility, that they've, you know, left their nationality behind, that they've left their nation behind, and they've gone, you know, to somewhere where they're now an outsider. But what about the kind of growing group of people who don't just have one place where they belong, but actually belong to more than one place? And this group is just going to keep growing. And for those people, such as myself, I'm half Polish and half English. And I will never really decide where I, you know, if I belong here or in Poland, because for me it's 50-50, and I think that's okay. But I think that there should be some kind of more, there should be a conversation with new semantics of people who are not just an insider or an outsider, but something in the middle that is legitimate or not legitimate, but we need to decide where that is. And I think that it's something that's going to keep growing. That I'd like to ask you, do you think that our traditional ideas of nationality and belonging, are they sustainable in the kind of the current climate where we will continue to mix and mix and with no end?
Simon already chomping at the bit to have a go at this one.
The wonderful question. In the 1880s, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche started asking that kind of question, and he saw coming in Europe a movement away from primarily or exclusively national identifications towards what he called a good European. But he described them at one point, when you said you were looking for a word, he called them cosmopolitan plants. Now, cosmopolitan plants, if you look at it in the dictionary, they're things that just grow anywhere. And his idea was there that these are people, human beings, who are not so tied to any particular milieu, cultural or political or social milieu, but could, as it were, thrive anywhere. And he saw in Europe developing, precisely for the same kind of reasons Kant did, of this kind of incredible interconnectedness of this space, people who would be literally at home anywhere. And so I think we are becoming, a lot of people, I mean, one of the issues is it's rather looked at a kind of elite group. But there is coming this group of more cosmopolitan plants among us. And there is also in Britain something that Pat mentioned. He said that English has this kind of ethno-racial boundary to it, which I think it does still. But because the UK is made up of three countries already, so it already has four countries already. So it has a plurality inside it. There's this, somehow this conceptual space for diversity within being British that there isn't really in terms of being English. And so one can always try to find those terms in which your internal diversity can be.
Self-describing yourself as English was one of the biggest predictors of voting to leave the EU.
Right.
I mean, yes, it's obviously a really great question, and I'm reminded of a student who very recently actually in class was saying, well, he's Franco-Spanish. But I think one of the things we forget is how situated identities are and can be, because he says when he's in France, he's considered to be Spanish, and when he's in Spain, he's considered to be French. So there are also those kinds of issues of how people are perceived, how they perceive themselves.
Really is a citizen of nowhere.
But, or a citizen of everywhere, of course. This is the ideal, but I think also we too often forget about mixed identities, the flexibility of identities, but also how they are situated. And at any different moment of the day, one can be one thing or another. One could also identify, you know, as there are all kinds of things one can identify during the day, work or not work, or you know, I don't know, you know, male, female. I mean, there are all kinds of things. And so clearly national identities have been a big one for the last couple of centuries. And so that is where we're stuck with these different definitions. And one can hope that citizens of everywhere would be a good possible category. The question is whether both countries allow you to do it perfectly at the same time and when or not. But
there isn't yet a global database of people's citizenships, but technology could mean that this is coming. I have a friend of mine who has six citizenships, and I asked her, how is that possible? And she said, well, when you get a new passport from somewhere, she's got American, Canadian, German, Turkish, and British, and so five. So when you ask, I said to her, some of these countries don't allow these multiple citizenships.
Right.
How does it work? She said, well, you fill in your...
All know.
You hand over your passport, and you go back to the consulate and say, I've lost my passport, can I have a new one? And they give you a new one. There isn't yet a global database. Anyway, pardon.
Yeah, I was thinking of an interesting conversation in the 1930s between Senghor, a Senegalese French politician, writer, poet, and a friend of his from Yugoslavia. And the man from Yugoslavia, who was also a friend of Césaire, actually at that time Césaire visited him and his wife in Yugoslavia later. So this man from Yugoslavia was talking about the flexibility of his identities. He said, you know, I'm French now and then. Sometimes I disclose my Yugoslavian part. I play with that. It's all about flexibility, etc. Sangar said, fine, but this is not my experience. My experience is not that of this flexibility, the possibility to disclose your, let's say, Polish part or Yugoslavian part. His experience, Senghor, in the 1930s was that very rigid experience of being symbolically sent back to Africa. He couldn't choose to disclose the country where he was coming from. It was visible, literally. It was visible. So what I want to stress here is that this experience of multiple identity can be very different because of race, because of the racial factor. So, and I think that a lot of people in Europe, white people, are not aware of this rigidity when it comes to the experience of being seen as foreign, in other words.
Okay, I think we should take a group of questions here. Guy in the middle there with a beard.
Oh,
yeah. There's a mic coming across if you want to be on the podcast.
So especially big cities in both Europe and America have been faster to embrace these transnationalism-related concepts than the countries they belong to. Mm. And that's becoming, of course, increasingly apparent. Of course, London, great example. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on whether this is a situation that can be resolved or is going to end basically with sharper boundaries being imposed on these cities.
Between cities and others. Oh, very good. Okay. Question at the back there. We've had a few down the front. All the way at the back. Just speak anyway.
Yeah. So thank you very much for everything. As an educationalist, what I'd just like to ask your opinion on the British values that have come into effect in schools. Do you guys know what they are, or are you fully aware of what they are? Shut up for the people that are not so familiar.
We can talk about this probably. Simon and the two Simons can talk about this.
Okay, yeah.
Very British names. woman all the way down the front. Sorry about the microphone jumping around here. But
yeah.
Here we go.
Hey.
And then we'll stop with those three. Yes.
Quick question around kind of going back to that dual nationality, sometimes just imposed because of who your parents are. If we kind of think back to Soviet Union, which is my personal experience, where, you know, it was a bunch of different nationalities coming together in the same federal state, nobody kind of, well, some people still thought twice, but lots of people didn't think twice about people from different nationalities marrying. There was no real legal issues with that. When the nation broke up, you saw all new kinds of concerns about people's nationality. And though, you know, everyone is theoretically more or less white in Soviet Union, there was a real kind of people could see where you came from. And so there was all of a sudden this negative energy towards people like that. Do you see, as you're thinking about European Union that has been kind of stable for a little while and kind of experienced that same thing, you know, Polish, British, French, Spanish. Now that this is starting to show cracks, do you think there will be a real backlash against people who kind of really embraced it? And what's going to happen? And when does it stop, right? Because in Soviet Union or former Soviet Union, it hasn't for 20 years. So
wow. Okay.
Where's the light at the end of the tunnel?
If unions break up, what happens to cosmopolitans? British values, agenda, and big cities. Pick one of them. Who wants to go first?
Just one comment to the last question or comment is that it also shows the constructed nature of these differences, how difference is constructed. You were saying that these differences weren't visible before, and then they become visible after a certain political moment. And I was struck because, of course, Fanon felt, I mean, he describes it as others have too, it's when you move also that all of a sudden that the boundaries or the become visible. So again, it's sort of, it's contextual. Friedrich Barth wrote about the contextuality of ethnicity and ethnic boundaries, and which is both, I don't know if that's encouraging or discouraging. I mean, because and indeed they are constructed in ways, and we see that politics are constructing them in very new ways in the last like year or so that are quite striking and worrisome.
Pub? Cities? Do you want to say something about cities? No. Okay. New boundaries being created between cities and multinational.
I do.
Simon?
Okay, go ahead first. Let me think about cities first.
He wants to say about everything. So
no, that is the one I would think about. Because actually it's the one I find most puzzling. The standard view would be the standard view that I myself might accept for the most part would be that London's this weird and special place in Britain, and basically as soon as you leave London, you're in another country where levels of xenophobia go through the roof, where everybody's white, nobody wants to meet anybody who isn't. Well, it's not really like that.
No.
And I wonder, like, there are lots of reasons why London gets sort of magnetised around a certain kind of identity that doesn't belong anywhere else. I mean, it is a massively international place, of course, but Britain is an incredibly diverse population everywhere. And so we shouldn't overemphasize that. And what I'd like to think is this, that there's those two people I mentioned earlier, Levinas and Derrida, they both said the same thing about ethics. Levinas said, ethics is hospitality. And Derrida said, hospitality is culture. And what they meant was that the way we relate to the stranger tells you something essential about the ethos of the home, right? And London has been incredible, like, in that capacity to take, for centuries, for hundreds of years, wave after wave of migrations and so on. But Britain as a whole has too, and I don't want to get romantically nostalgic about Britain's capacity to be non-xenophobic, because we know there are tragic histories in there. But there's also something, there have been qualities of Britain which are more welcoming than one might sometimes imagine, and the people who wanted to leave the European Union in Britain, I wonder how far that had a xenophobic accent. It may have done, but towards, for example, non-Muslims, which had nothing to do with Europe.
Yeah, to me, the one of the main striking issues is that of the question, I mean, how do we build a European civil society that would not, and there is already one, obviously, that of cities, students, upper classes in Europe exchanging, people who voted against Brexit here, obviously in London. London had a huge majority, if I remember well, against the Brexit. Paris will vote against the National Front, the same as New York and Los Angeles voted against Trump a few weeks ago. So the point is to figure out how can we build a cosmopolitan civil society that does include popular classes, that does include those who are left and who feel that cosmopolitanism, foreign countries are the enemy. So to me, that's really the issue. How do we rebuild forms of democracies that make foreignness, that make transnational connections an ally to the class situation which people experience?
Let me say something about the British values question, yeah, which we haven't answered. I mean, I think of this in comparative terms, in that this, for those of you who are unaware, you know, I'm a governor of a secondary school in London, and one of the debates in the curriculum is we have to apply a British values in the curriculum, which is a euphemism for a variety of different things, which is about trying to, about one side of it is a more liberal conception of social integration, and one side of it is a more kind of nativist national conception of particularly aimed, I think, at Muslim communities in particular, about being integrated into British society. But that same conversation is going on across a lot of democracies. My sister lives in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, there's the new citizenship test in the Netherlands requires all new immigrants to watch a film about life in the Netherlands, which shows people who are topless on the beach, gay couples kissing, and people smoking dope. And again, this is largely conceived as being directed at imams.
Sure.
And, of course, the imams are saying to their new members, if you go and watch that citizenship film, shut your eyes and cover your ears. So this is an interest. It's a debate going on about the fact that, and I think a lot of these issues relate to the fact that my wife has worked in migration for 20 years, and her boss in this think tank in Brussels has said, in the 20th century, the big challenge for states was to come to terms with the de facto free movement of goods and capital. And we struggled for a century with this. And the big challenge of this century is to come to terms with the de facto movement of people. There's nothing we can really do to stop this. It will carry on going, and it will just get bigger, and we have to figure out how we deal with this. And you know, so maybe this is a bit of a backlash against it, but it's not going to stop it, and these issues are not going to go away.
But it's not entirely new.
No,
I mean,
that's right.
There have been periods.
But the
people have
of
been
it
mo-
is,
okay, but the people have been moving for a long
sure.
time. There have been anti-immigration laws and periods of xenophobia before. So the question is then how to get back to the periods when there is less of it. And one of the things which I've always found very persuasive is also thinking about those periods of disliking the newcomers is often related to being, again, what one feels about oneself. And so it's the uncertainties, it's the anxieties about one's own society, which you then create looking around for, well, who can we blame this on? And so it's easy to blame it on newcomers or outsiders. So the question is how to get back a sort of sense of self without falling into the nativist exclusionary category.
We've got time for one quick round of questions. One over here. And then one in the middle here. And then one over the side down here.
Okay. Cheers. Pat. Is Pat? Yep. How do you get past that? Maybe what I'm thinking is that personal experience is the key. And that's the only thing. But how do you make that happen? I don't know how you make that happen. Maybe that's why Paris and London are so accepting to people, because the people are next door to them.
Yeah.
And they're living with them, and they're going shopping with them, and they're going to school with them. And that's the only... I can only see that that's the only way. I don't know how that happens, but I don't think that you can expect people who have never experienced life with different cultures and different beliefs and different... to be accepting. I think personal experience is the only key.
Very good point. We'll come back to that. There was a who did I point to second? I can't remember. I think it was the man in the middle here. Yeah.
Yes, thank you for that most invigorating deliveries from the front line. My issue is that you mentioned the new forms of transnationalism in terms of European states. And I hate the term, but post-Brexit, we have borders, boundaries, frontiers, languages, laws, mobility, and the problems of anxieties and insecurities within the European construct. Can pluralism ever be part of a process of taking it to the next stage of human development?
And we have about a minute each to answer this. Okay. And then over this corner here, final question. Down the third row back, okay. Woman on the end.
Coming. Thank you.
Hi, I was just wondering if you might comment on the phenomenon of transnational discrimination. I don't know if that's the right term, but for instance, this week we're expecting an executive order from President Trump, which will ban certain dual citizens from traveling to the US. So this further leads to minorities like myself, I'm Canadian, British and Iranian, being prevented, but for my Canadian passport, from going to the US and kind of further feeling a minority, a community that's not spoken to, that we're not a big enough group of people within this country for it to warrant Theresa May's concern in her upcoming discussions, that if it was all Christians are banned, then I'm sure there'd be an outcry. But for all Iranians, when I was at work talking about it, they said, yeah, but Iran's one of those terrorist countries, right? So, and as other examples, you know, I grew up in the UAE, my parents still live out there. If I wanted to go and live and work out there now, my born in Iran and my British passport prevents me from that. My ticking a box that says I'm originally Shia, albeit atheist now, bans me from that. I have no recourse from that. I traveled to Morocco a year ago on my Canadian passport. It says born in Iran on it. They demanded to see my Iranian passport, crossed out my form that said I was Canadian, and granted me a visa there because they determined that I was Iranian and nothing more. So just if we could comment on these phenomenons, because in principle, I'm a citizen of all of these places. I have all these rights. I have many identities, but at the end of the day, my passport gives me rights. You know, that's what I try and tell people, is I come from a country where I don't have rights. My Iranian government is going to do certain things and not others. Just to comment on this, sorry.
Wow. So pick what you can out of that. Very short sure, comments. Leave you last. Pap, do you want to go first with any of these?
Just a word on dual citizenship, which is targeted in the United States. You rightly mentioned Trump. It is also, it's been targeted in France following the terrorist attacks when the French Parliament almost voted a law transforming dual... That's right, withdrawing citizenship to dual citizens. And this would have, and this created a major debate in France. But many people started to ask a year ago, isn't Najat Vallaud-Belkacem, she's the Minister for Education in France, because, and she has dual citizenship, France and Morocco. People starting to raise questions and doubts about her her citizenship and her right to be a minister in France.
A foreign minister who's a dual citizen.
And it is also seen as a problem for extreme right organizations.
Surprisingly, it's not a problem.
Not yet.
Nobody
okay. It's going to come. In any case, I'm struck by how a political issue has emerged in France around this issue of dual citizenship, and this is something which nationalist organizations are making a lot about.
Thank you, Pap. Nancy.
Alas, I'm not so surprised about it. I think it also shows what the limits of transnationalism. On the one hand, multiple passport holders and multiple passports are celebrated as a real sign of transnationalism, and yet you've given us a very good example of how that in itself doesn't even work always. I must remind you, though, all that, in fact, that the acceptance of dual or multiple passports is of a fairly recent nature. 1960s, 1970s, the idea was every person had one identity, one passport, and that was it.
It's quite recent.
And it's really from the latter part of all countries, United States, did not accept dual citizenship except for people born of their own citizens but living abroad. So there were certain kinds of exceptions. Or if you didn't ask for another citizenship but it was given to you, then de facto you had it. But by the end of the 20th century, and partly because of the increased mobility, but also the countries of origin who were becoming concerned that they were losing too many of their citizens and wanted to keep them as part and to maintain good flows of remittances, started saying that they were going to allow their citizens to take on the citizenship of the country where they were living and not and accept that as a de facto dual citizenship from the part of the, that was on the part of the countries of origin. This then more or less forced the countries of settlement to agree in the sense that they would, or they would have a blind, take a blind eye to the fact that someone who became a citizen of the country of their country where they were living had not actually gotten rid of their passport of origin. So it's been actually sort of a recent phenomenon, the kind of at least more open acceptance of dual citizenship or multiple citizenship. We may now be coming to the end of that, it's quite simply. Unfortunately, this is just another sign of what's going on.
1 minute on contact hypothesis and pluralism as the future.
Yeah. It was such a brilliant question on pluralism, and I thought it had to be taken up. And the way I try to pursue it in relation to things I've been saying about hospitality would be to invite us to think about what we mean when we say you're welcome. In English, but I think in other languages too, if you say to somebody, you're welcome, there's at least two things you mean, and it's really bizarre. One is, you can join in any of this. You're not excluded from any of this. You're welcome. But we can also mean, you don't have to join in any of this. You're not obliged to belong to any of this. You're welcome. Right? So, welcome seems to hold within it the thought of a demand both to integrate and to respect the alterity, the otherness of the other. And while we have that kind of duality in the concept of the welcome, of hospitality, I think there's got to be in that some space which is about the recognition of a plurality, and that you'll never get away from something like a respect for cultural diversity as long as you respect that contradiction inside hospitality.
We could go on all night, but thank you all for coming, and thank you to the